Did you happen to catch the Westworld season finale this past weekend? Do you have some questions? We know just the guy to ask. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 26th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Westworld coming up in the second half of the program. But first, the Supreme Court agreed with President Trump today, as you have been hearing, and upheld the third version of his travel ban. Citizens of five mostly Muslim-majority countries and two others are now forbidden to enter the United States without a specific waiver. The White House has said throughout the year and a half or so of appeals on this case that the ban is meant to improve national security. A lot of businesses and industries, especially in technology, say there will be economic pain, though. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams checked in with some of those businesses today.
More than 150 tech firms joined the legal challenges against the ban. And today, several said their original points still stand. John Geschke at Zendesk says the policy will limit diversity in the tech industry.
And even for those which we can continue to employ, it will, just on the basis of their nationality, restrict their ability to travel freely to and from the United States.
But he and others like Chris Lehane of Airbnb say that's not the only reason they oppose the ban.
For Airbnb, no, it's not impacting, you know, our economic bottom line, but it certainly implicates the values and what we believe in.
While big tech firms may not be taking a big economic hit from the ban, that's not the case for other industries, says Stephen Yale Layer at Cornell University.
Tourism, for example, the number of international students applying to U.S. colleges has dropped. So I think that the travel ban, although it may be constitutional, is having an adverse impact on our economy.
Mark Boyer experienced that firsthand. He's head of the International Studies Association. Their conference last year was just after the first travel ban was announced, and more than 100 people canceled at the last minute.
Which ended up being about a $30,000 hit, which is somewhere between 10 and 15% of our net revenue from a convention annually anyways.
Because of the ban, he says his group has shifted its business model, hosting more conferences outside the U.S. to accommodate those who can't get in. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A quick detour to oil here for a second before we go on. Crude in New York closed back over $70 a barrel for the first time in a couple of months. The proximate cause was the State Department saying it expects other countries to cut their imports of Iranian oil to zero by November or face American sanctions if they don't. All right, back to the T word now. Trade is a T word. Also tariffs, that's another T word. And taxes as well. The hope from supporters of the new tax law that passed the end of last year had been that companies would take their new lower tax rate and invest the savings, put it to productive use and bump economic growth. Thing is, there are now Trump tax increases on the books as well, tariffs on a bunch of imports from China, as well as on steel and aluminum for much of the rest of the world. You throw in those reciprocal tariffs that are already kicking in, and what you got is a tax cut and a tax increase at the same time. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains how that might work.
Let's one hand, other hand, these tax cuts and tariffs. On the one hand, companies are saving a bunch of cash thanks to lower corporate tax rates.
To the extent that companies are banking the tax cut and they can set up reserves, yeah, they're better off.
Len Berman is co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. On Berman's other hand, raising tariffs means higher taxes on certain imports.
Basically, it can change a lot of prices in the American economy and make a lot of activities unprofitable that had been profitable a few months ago.
Tax cuts give, tariffs take. So how does this all net out? Jason Furman is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School.
The tax cut is about $200 billion. The tariffs are in the low tens of billions of dollars. So just quantitatively, the tax cuts are much larger than the tariffs.
But if this trade spat escalates into a full-blown trade war, that would erode the economic benefits the tax cuts were supposed to bring, says Ken Smetters at the Penn Wharton budget model. Let's say a trade war cuts global trade in half.
Essentially, half of the benefits of the tax cut get wiped out in the first decade. And by 2040, we actually lose all the benefits plus 50%.
It took a lot of fighting and wrangling in Congress last year to get corporations a tax cut. But Smetters says the way trade policy works, the president can undo the benefits of those tax cuts all on his own. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Big winner on Wall Street today, GE. Just a day after getting bumped out of the Dow Industrials, the granddaddy of American conglomerates picked up almost 8% on news that it's going to sell off some divisions and further deconglomeratize itself. Otherwise, it was a fine day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a case pending in federal district court in Boston that could wind up being a big deal in higher education. It's Students for Fair Admissions, plaintiff v. President and Fellows of Harvard College, defendant. The school is accused of systematically discriminating against Asian Americans, many of whom are qualified to get into Harvard. It's a case that revolves around affirmative action and how it plays out in college admissions, and it raises a whole bunch of questions, not least of which is what do we know and what don't we know about why certain students are admitted and others aren't. Marketplace's Rima Kreis takes a look.
A few years back, when he was a high school student in New York, Eric Smiley obsessed over college, preparing himself to get into a top school. And then, just a week before the deadline,
I did 18 applications in 4 days.
Like a true teenager, he procrastinated.
Yeah, that's putting it gently.
Still, Smiley, who's 24 now and works as an economic consultant in L.A., got them all in on time. Apps to Duke, Boston College, Yale, Harvard, Tufts.
If you throw a bunch of 10% darts at a board, some of them are going to hit.
4 of them hit. Lots of his reach schools stayed out of reach. He expected that. But he wasn't expecting this.
I thought I would get into Michigan.
Smiley graduated at the top of his class, played baseball, marched in the band, was on the Quiz Bowl team, and had a near-perfect SAT score. He ended up at Tufts, but the Michigan thing, he still doesn't get it.
You kind of never know exactly what they're going for.
You can't predict it.
Zach Harris is a former admissions officer at George Washington and Johns Hopkins University.
I remember getting phone calls every single year from parents who would say, you know, my son has this and this SAT score or this and this GPA. You know, how come they weren't admitted?
But the answer those parents were really looking for is how come those other students were? Michelle Hernandez is a former admissions officer at Dartmouth. She says the process is more art than science, particularly now. Colleges and universities, especially elite ones, are under mounting pressure to admit a diverse pool of students, racially, socioeconomically, geographically.
So you're constantly shifting your parameters as you're evaluating applicants because you're looking at, did they have any hardship? What's their socioeconomic status? I mean, you're inferring a lot, right? You have to be a detective.
That detective work produces what many schools call a holistic evaluation.
It's individualized review to see who they are beyond just their test scores and grades.
Oyen Poon is a professor of higher ed at Colorado State University. She says there's a lot of misinformation about how so-called holistic review is related to affirmative action.
A lot of people assume that affirmative action is practiced as racial quotas or as racial preferences, such as bonus points, just by checking a demographic box.
Racial quotas are illegal. Considering race in admissions is not. But because it's such a gray area, more schools have backed away from affirmative action policies in recent years to avoid potentially costly lawsuits like the one Harvard is facing. They rely instead on other measures to help create diversity. The University of Chicago, for example, recently joined a growing list of schools that no longer require SAT and ACT scores. Natasha Wariku is an education professor at Harvard.
Now I think Chicago is saying, well, we see how the SAT creates barriers for non-traditional students, and so we're going to eliminate that.
But Wariku says there's no one right or quote-unquote fair way to approach admissions. And she thinks efforts to unveil the process through the Harvard lawsuit may not yield much. She has a different admissions process in mind for elite schools, where every candidate has perfect SAT scores and was high school valedictorian.
Maybe there should be, you know, after a certain bar, there should be some form of a lottery.
College as a game of chance.
It will never fly. That's the problem.
But she says a lottery could reduce the arbitrary nature of the whole process.
That admission to Harvard is like, you know, that's a ticket for many people. And is it fair that some people get that and some people don't?
It's a ticket, she says, that doesn't just open Harvard's door. It can open up a lot of other doors, too. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
There's transcontinental corporate news today that's part coffee, part that old real estate standby, location, location, location. The Los Angeles-based chain Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf says it's going to open 100 new stores in New York City over the next 10 years. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
To be clear, Coffee Bean isn't leaving L.A. It's just expanding. Or returning with a vengeance. The chain closed all of its dozen New York locations about a year and a half ago. But is now a good time to return? And is there a thirst for that much more coffee? Probably. Michael Schaefer follows the food and beverage industry for Euromonitor.
Daily trips to the coffee shop are less likely to be replaced by something you can order online.
Coffee shops are increasingly go-to spots for food and drink, so many analysts feel this move is sustainable in the near term. Another plus for Coffee Bean, there's a glut of empty storefronts in New York, so it's a renter's market. Patrice Darrington teaches real estate at Columbia University.
The effective rental rate at which tenants typically get to take up the space is often 40% below what is asking.
Plus, she says, New York is bumping up the threshold at which renters pay an additional tax. Coffee shops will get a break.
The good thing is that we now have smaller service operators coming in and being able to get affordable space.
That'll help make New York more livable. Euromonitor's Michael Schaefer warns, though, there is such a thing as too many coffee shops.
With so many people in the real estate industry, people in the coffee industry seeing positive long-term trends, that doesn't mean we can't overshoot in the near to midterm.
If we do, a lot of those stores could close again. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
TV is radically changing. So you can kind of make a TV series into whatever you want.
And that is exactly what Jonah Nolan did. Westworld, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 30 points today, about a 10%, 24,283. NASDAQ up 29, 0.3%, 75.61. S&P 500 up a mere 5 points, 0.2%, 27.23. Following Jed's story, look at a few New York-based commercial real estate companies, huh? JW May's up a 10%, Gramercy Property Trust unchanged. On Harley-Davidson, HOG is the ticker, HD, off 0.6%. Today on day two of the President of the United States versus a motorcycle company, bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for fact-based, unbiased news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our goal of 6,000 Marketplace investors this fiscal year. So please support public service journalism today at Marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a big European Union meeting in Brussels in a couple of days. On the agenda, in addition to the usual EU stuff, is what to do about Brexit and Ireland, because aside from the Brits themselves, the Irish will likely be the most economically affected by Brexit. It's kind of a bitter pill because Ireland's economy has come back strong after getting whacked in the financial crisis 10 years ago. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more now on the Irish turnaround.
If you want to see the Irish recovery in action, consider the case of Gillian Godsill. In the crisis, she lost her home, her marketing business, her marriage broke up, and she went bankrupt.
I'm very lucky that I never contemplated suicide, but I felt that total absence of hope, total absence, that dark, dark pit.
Today, she's brimming over with optimism, enthusing about her new and lucrative role marketing blockchain, the technology behind cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin.
I give talks at conferences around the world now, Middle East and Texas and Russia and Sri Lanka. I'm going to London next week to do one. And I chair conferences. And I also act as an advisor.
Her economic revival reflects the whole country's recovery. Many other workers and their employers have shown the same intelligence, flexibility and pragmatism and willingness to plug into the global marketplace. Exporting has been a key component of Ireland's salvation, not to mention sheer doggedness.
We are a very determined race, a very determined race.
Determination has been on display here at Combilift in County Monaghan. It makes innovative forklift trucks, exporting 98% of them. During the crisis, sales collapsed. CEO Martin McVicar took drastic action and laid off a quarter of the workforce.
The day that we made 43 employees redundant, we actually also introduced a 10% salary pay cut for all other employees. The employees were delighted to have a 10% pay cut, so at least they still held on to their job and their career.
And that tough remedial action saved the company.
Since it's grown over the last 10 years, we have recruited many of them, 43 people since, and our workforce has more than doubled in the last 5 years again. And that pay reduction is now well gone.
Nationally, unemployment, which peaked at 16% during the crisis, is now down to less than 6%. Last year, the country's economy grew at three times the Eurozone average, 7.8%. Danny McCoy is head of IBEC, Ireland's main business lobby group.
Ireland has been unlucky for generations and has now become incredibly lucky and has had the Midas touch.
That's not to say Ireland's recovery has been pain-free.
They don't care on cutbacks to our schools, to our special needs teachers.
At the height of the crisis, there were angry protests against the very strict austerity regime imposed by the government. Because it spent billions bailing out the banks, it then had to cut spending to the bone. Public sector salaries and pensions were slashed. Public workers, like nurse Sean Roburn, are still feeling the effects.
Does it feel as if this is the fastest growing economy in Europe?
I wouldn't say so, no, not at all, no. We haven't got our money back that we lost during the crash. We took big cut in wages around up 15-20%. We haven't got anywhere near that back yet at this stage.
Irish households remain heavily in debt. As a whole, they've borrowed 66% more of their disposable income than their US counterparts. So the Irish are vulnerable to any rise in interest rates. Brexit is another headwind. But at least Ireland is growing robustly and facing all the uncertainties with much more confidence today than in the recent past. In Dublin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Sunday night was the season finale of Westworld. Season 2 airs on HBO, co-created and run by Jonah Nolan and his wife Lisa Joy. For those not familiar, Westworld is dystopian. It's a little high concept, but also very much of a type with a lot of what's on TV right now. Jonah Nolan got his start in movies. He did a chunk of the Batman franchise with his brother Christopher. Jonah, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I know it's been over for you for a while, but is it a relief to have season two now out there and finally be done with it, I suppose?
It never quite feels over. it's great fun to finally share what we've been cooking up. We've got some very confused people, but I think overall we've got what seems like an audience that's happy and excited for where we're going in season three.
Well, it's interesting you say confused, because literally I was in our morning news meeting before I came in to talk to you, and they said, will you ask him what the hell happened in the finale?
I keep explaining this week to everybody that the first movie that I worked on with my brother was Backwards. So it feels like since then everything has gotten marginally less simple. In fact, that movie isn't even backwards. It's not quite backwards,
Well, that's kind of the point, right? It's not quite backwards. This finale was not quite confusing. It was a little bewildering, maybe. How much time do you spend, and I mean this in a logistical sense, keeping things straight? Because this is a complicated storyline.
It's a big storyline. It's a big ensemble world, which so many of the fantastic HBO shows are these omnibus ensembles with literally dozens of characters. We have a fantastic writing staff that Lisa and I collaborate with.
Lisa, your wife, we should say.
That's right. Lisa, my wife and partner on the show. Fantastic team. And there's a lot of whiteboards. There's a lot of whiteboards involved.
Do you look at this in the doing as a movie that you're breaking up into, I don't even know how many episodes were in the season, 10, 12, 15, whatever it was?
I'm not sure I know either, Kyle.
Which is a little scary. But is it a big, long movie for you, or are you thinking in installments, I guess, is the question?
So the analogy for us with this, I mean, TV is radically changing.
Yeah.
And so you can kind of make a TV series into whatever you want. Certainly in the first season, we were moving pieces around to try to figure out how best to tell the story. In movie terms, you'd be taking events from real 23 and moving them to real 30 to make sure that it all tracks for the audience.
What does that even mean, real 23 to real 30?
So when I started in the movie,
R-E-E-L, like the reel of the movie.
That's it.
Aha, okay, yeah. Sorry.
Each of them about 20 minutes, little cigarette burns that let the projectionist know the next one's coming in. And right. So in a film, you might move something from reel 3 to reel 4. In a TV series like this one, we'd be moving scenes, moments throughout the 10-hour period, which creates challenges for our editors.
Let me get back to this moving things from reel 30 to reel 22 to back to reel 7 again. And I asked this question of Hiro Murai, the guy who does Atlanta with Donald Glover. Yeah. I asked him the other day whether he is worried about losing people, losing the audience, because there are so many moving parts and it's so confusing. And the same question applies to Westworld, I think. Do you worry about losing people as you make those creative decisions?
Yeah, without a doubt. My whole career is based on the premise that the audience, in many regards, was underestimated. That the prevailing mindset when I moved to Hollywood in 1998 was you had to dumb everything down. I mean, you can't imagine how many times you get that note. Huh. But you do have to be careful. One of the challenges we realized for us in the first season was we're not only asking people to keep track of a number of characters and a number of storylines and a number of timelines, but we're also asking them to step into a world whose rules are a little different. And when you add that to the mix, it means that you have to recalibrate how much you're putting into the audience's mind in any given moment. And we're constantly asking that question.
So as you sit here now with season 2 done and out, and I don't know where you are in the production process of season 3, I imagine you're taking something of a breather, but how intently are you focused on, given the confusion about the finale with which we started, right, how intently are you focused on getting people back to solid ground where they can understand what's going on?
You know, our intention with every season was more analogous to the franchise film model. The way that we approached it on the Batman movies was you don't leave much on the table. You tell it all in one movie, and if you get the good fortune to go again, then you pick up and figure out what that movie is going to look like. Each movie, in other words, telling a complete story that hopefully opens the door to an interesting... That sounded like an inadvertent plug for the theme of the season, but it wasn't. opening a door to another season, but not requiring the audience to watch that. One of the most complimentary things I heard about the first season that made me very happy was people saying, I don't know if I need to see another season of that show. I mean, obviously you want people watching your show, but you also want them satisfied with what they've watched.
That's so interesting. Because if I were a creator, I'd be like, what do you mean you don't want to watch season 2? You're killing me, man.
Well, that's where TV lived for 65 years. You want everyone to, you know, the entire history of the medium has been about keeping people tuned in.
Yeah.
I think we're in a different moment now. I think we're in a moment in which, obviously, it's important. All more challenging than it ever has been, with 500 plus shows on the air, to reach people, to get them to come watch your show. But one of the beauties of working at a place like HBO is it's a slightly different model. So it's really about making sure that the audience is fascinated with what you're doing.
Jonah Nolan, Westworld. Season 2 is out there. Season 3 coming. When are we going to see season 3? Or don't you get to decide that?
My wife and I are going to take our kids on vacation, and I'll have an answer for you when we get back.
All right. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Kai. It's a pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, one clue perhaps as to the stock market's performance the past 6 months or so. Yes, companies like the Trump administration's attitude on deregulation, that much we know, but they like the tax law more. With lots of money in corporate pockets, thanks to that tax bill, S&P Dow Jones Indices, which tracks these kinds of things, says stock buybacks hit a record the first quarter of this year. That's in the category you might have heard a lot about during the debate on the tax bill, that companies would return value to shareholders, and that much is true. What stock buybacks are not are capital investments or higher wages. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 30 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ advanced 29 points, about 0.3%. S&P 500 up 5 points. That is 0.2%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. While I've got their names on the tip of your tongue, follow us on Instagram, would you? At Marketplace APM. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.